Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. The Rules of Investing gets inside the minds of leading investors, economists, and industry experts, and it's brought to you by Livewire Markets. Today's guest is Andrew Lockhart, co-founder and managing partner at Metrics Credit Partners. Before starting Metrics nearly 9 years ago, Andrew worked at NAB for an incredible 26 years, eventually ending up as a director focused on private credit transactions. In this episode, we discuss his experience during the GFC and how it's shaped his investment philosophy today, how Australia's big banks have changed the way they fund themselves, and the sectors that he'd be avoiding if the market closed for 5 years. Before we get into the show, I wanted to let you know that Livewire Markets has recently launched a new podcast called Buy, Hold, Sell. If you're a Livewire subscriber, you should be familiar with Buy, Hold, Sell already, as we release the series in video format every Friday. Well, Buy, Hold, Sell is now available in a podcast format, which you can access through Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Buy, Hold, Sell features two fund managers who each offer their view, buy, hold, or sell, on a selection of well-known and relevant stocks. And as always, if you're loving the rules of investing, why not tell someone about it? Pick your favourite episode and send it to a friend, or just head on over to Apple Podcasts and hit subscribe. Either way, you're helping to increase the profile of the podcast, and therefore the quality of the guests that I can bring to you. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the show. It's good to have you on.
Thanks, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to get to know you a little bit first. Our audience might not be 100% familiar with your background and where you come from. So I'd like to talk a little bit about founding Metrics and how that happened. I noticed from looking at your history that you were at NAB for well over 20 years. You were a director there. It seems like I wouldn't say easy, but it definitely a rewarding job to be in. What made you kind of want to go out on your own and leave the relative safety of that important role at NAB and start Metrics with your partners?
Yeah, sure. Look, I think for myself, working at NAB was a great experience, great training ground, saw a lot of different and interesting transactions and met a lot of interesting and good people through that period of time. I was fortunate that I also studied part-time through that period of time. And so I guess my initial learnings were from both my studies, but also from my direct work experience at NAB. And as you say, I worked there for 26 years across a range of different roles. So what actually happened with the establishment of Metrics was really back in 2008, myself and a couple of my partners really in the eye of the storm, effectively at the time of the GFC, we were asked to bring our team together, and we were advised that NAB had made some decisions that was likely to have a material impact on the business unit that I was working in. They were concerned around the availability of capital, and they were also concerned about potential credit risk and losses that might eventuate. Myself and two of my partners had been intimately involved in that particular business unit at NAB, and really we saw it as a great opportunity to sort of make a proposal or a business proposal to NAB to sort of say, look, you know, the market is going to change as a result of the GFC. We really formed the view that the banks would be subject to increasing regulatory pressure, and as a result of that, increasing cost of funding pressure. But if you think about the way in which banks in Australia tend to manage their risk, they largely distribute and manage their risk amongst other banks. And so there's a high degree of systemic risk that the banks were exposed to. And so we proposed a proposal to NAB to establish an independent funds management business, really giving our investors the opportunity to gain direct exposure to Australian corporate loans. And then over a period of time between 2008 to 2013, we worked away internally within NAB to establish what has become Metrics Credit Partners. And then we were fortunate that we raised some capital from one of our initial investors, and we started the business in June of 13.
You touched momentarily on the GFC there. I'd like to hear a little bit more about that, if I could. I mean, private debt markets seem like they would have been a rather, I guess, scary place to be during the height of the GFC. Certainly in the US, debt was, you know, kind of forefront of the experience that a lot of people were having. So what was your experience like working in those private debt markets during that period, and how does it affected your philosophy and your processes today?
It was an interesting time. I think if you really look at what occurred at the time of the GFC, it wasn't so much about the real economy. It was more to do with the way in which the financial institutions around the world financed themselves, and a loss of confidence amongst that sector in relation to counterparty risk. And so in Australia, you had a situation where a number of the foreign banks were materially impacted as a result of what was happening back in their home markets. So groups like RBS, Bank of Scotland, a number of the American banks were impacted. A number of the French banks and European banks withdrew from the market. And so all of a sudden, there was a real tightening in availability of capital. And so what ended up happening, I guess, is that the domestic major banks were able to assert their dominance through attracting retail and additional deposits to finance their books or their loan books, reducing their reliance on wholesale funding markets. But you also had the benefit of the government guarantee coming through. And so as a result of that, the banks here in Australia were able to finance their operations and were able to continue to fund Australian corporates. They really expanded their balance sheets as their competitors, particularly foreign bank competitors, withdrew. And so what that really highlighted for us was the fact that the Australian economy was very reliant on wholesale funding and foreign bank capital. And you've got a situation through the way in which the superannuation sector is set up that a lot of capital now bypasses the banks. And so when, I guess, the banks have problems in terms of financing their commitments and the values of their balance sheet assets, you know, there are broader flow-on effects. And so I guess, you know, firsthand seeing the impact that had on Australian corporate borrowers and the difficulty they experience in terms of raising funding and the flow through impact in terms of cost of funding was material. I think if you look back over that period of time, you know, what really occurred too was, you know, the withdrawal of bank capital caused Australian corporate borrowers quite a lot of concern. You had funding gaps appearing in corporate balance sheets, you know, as a result of, you know, different banks withdrawing from syndicates. You know, and as a result of that, the cost of funding went higher. And really, the people that bore the brunt of that were the shareholders. You know, you saw a number of large companies that completed deeply dilutive equity raisings. You know, there'd been some large debt-funded acquisitions that had been completed, and well-known household names and, you know, top, you know, tier ASX corporates were really forced into a position where they needed to raise additional capital and lower their lower the balance sheet risk to obtain funding. The other thing that occurred during that period of time was the banks shortened up the terms of funding. So at that period of time, it was very difficult to get bank funding beyond 3 years. So there was a lot of flow-on effects into the broader economy as a result of the tightening in financial markets. I guess from our perspective, the way in which that has impacted us, you know, like we very much believe in, you know, lending for shorter periods of time, generally between 3 and 5 years. And the reason we do that is that we believe it actually is beneficial for our investors. We think it lowers the credit risk that investors are exposed to. So you can forecast the performance of a company in the short period of time. Going out 10, 15, 20 years becomes a much higher risk proposition to project the forward financial projections of the companies you lend to. We also think it lowers the market risk our investors are exposed to. So, for instance, back in the GFC, you had a number of foreign banks that were doing long-dated project and infrastructure debt facilities at very fine margins. And when the credit market turned and the cycle turned, the rates were materially higher. And as a result of that, there was a flow through in terms of mark-to-market losses to those lenders that had lent for extended periods of time. We also think it enhances the liquidity of your underlying portfolio because you get a regular maturity profile, which enhances the liquidity options for our investors, but it also drives fee income and returns. So if you can lend a company money today and then a year or two's time, they want to refinance or borrow more money, then that's an opportunity to charge a further fee and generate income for your investors.
How have things changed since then, do you think? You referred there to the funding mix and how that was very concentrated before, and there was a lot of risk in the way the banks shared this debt around. Do you think that those issues have been largely ironed out now, or has that been spread, or do some of those issues still underlying at the base of things?
Look, there's been a material change in the way in which banks finance their activities. So people that hold deposits would see that the banks are far more restrictive in terms of allowing depositors to break terms and their charge fees and penalties. That's largely as a result of the regulatory impact. So, the banks are subject to, net stable funding ratios. So they're looking for a well-diversified, broader spread of retail and sticky deposit money that would otherwise have been, and probably at a lower cost for the banks, allowed them to raise funding in through wholesale debt capital markets. So there's been a fundamental change in the way in which banks finance their activities. But I guess from our perspective, really what that demonstrates is that, banks are in business to generate a net interest margin and an income. And so, the differential between the rates they lend and the amount that they pay away to borrow to depositors is obviously what drives the short-term profitability and returns available to banks. And so what that gave us was an opportunity to say, well, if we can establish a funds management where we can contain and lower the costs, and we can give investors direct exposure to a well-diversified portfolio, and we can provide our investors with the full returns that the banks would generate through fees and interest margins and the like that were charged to borrowers, and we can do it for a lower cost because of the size and scale of our business, then our investors would pick up a better return. And that's really what we've been able to deliver now over the last 6.5 years.
Well, let's take a step back for a second, and I just want to discuss some of the basics of exactly what your asset class is, private credit, and what is it and why should investors pay attention? So could you give us a bit of an elevator pitch? Let's say you had, 30 to 60 seconds to explain it to a new investor who'd never heard of private credit before. How would you explain it to them and why they should be interested?
It's a very difficult thing to do in 30 seconds. The asset class is very broad. It's not a homogenous asset class. It's not a market where people can buy and sell over the exchange like they do with equities. Every transaction is bespoke. Every transaction is heavily negotiated. And our role as a lender is to really understand the risks associated with lending to certain companies that we provide funding to, and then to make sure that we've negotiated the right price and we've structured the right deal to minimize the risk of loss to us as a lender. So effectively, private credit is raising capital on one side from investors and then looking for the opportunity to lend. So really, for a lot of investors, it's their means of gaining an indirect lending relationship with some of the very largest and most successful companies that operate in this market.
So just to clarify for the sake of the audience, so you're actually going out there meeting directly with the individual companies and you're lending directly to them rather than so for example, if you're invested in a junk bond fund, for example, your asset manager is going to go out into the market and he's going to buy securities on the market. You're actually going out and meeting face-to-face with these companies, aren't you, and getting into their books and really getting a feel for their businesses. Is that right?
That's exactly 100% correct. So from our perspective, if you're a buy-side person, you're used to dealing in public market securities, be it bonds or high-yield bonds or investment-grade bonds or equities. Often you have no ability to set the terms or conditions or the pricing. You don't negotiate the security. You're not involved in meeting with management on a day-to-day basis. And you're not necessarily privy to private side information that we are as a lender. And so our role is very much really dig into the detail, understand management strategy, what it is that drives the cash flows associated with the companies or the projects that we lend to, and then look to negotiate those lending opportunities directly with the companies.
I was looking at the returns on one of your listed investment trusts, which since listing had been producing income at a rate of around 7%. This, of course, at a time when the RBA cash rate is down around 1%. How do the risk profiles of the investments that you're making compare to, for example, say, listed equities or US junk bonds?
Yeah, look, I think the key difference is what we're looking to do is not to take on additional risk just simply to generate a return. A large component of our return comes from what we believe are market inefficiencies. And so the Australian market is very much a bank-dominated, heavily regulated lending market. But there are companies that look to do things where it just doesn't make sense for a bank to lend because of the regulated nature of the capital that they are required to hold. So if you think about a bank, they're heavily leveraged. The regulator sets certain terms and conditions around the kinds of assets or the kinds of companies and the structures that they can agree to lend. But for us as a unlevered, unregulated lender, what you're looking to do is to negotiate, what's the appropriate transaction? What is the price? Negotiate a fair and reasonable price for the investor capital that we're providing. So our view is that there are often situations where our investor capital is scarce and our investors should be rewarded for that scarcity of capital. So I often think about it in the context of good and bad uses of debt. Often, for instance, a classic case is, a property mezzanine transaction. It might be a small transaction. The person that's looking to raise the funding mightn't have the financial wherewithal and resources to be able to complete the project, and they're scratching around for a small amount of mezzanine finance, which is really akin to sort of more equity-like risk. That's not the kind of activity that we specialise in. The contrast is a large development group. They've owned a property for a number of years. They've made a substantial gain over, say, 10 years as a result of, say, a rezoning of the land, getting a development approval, selling and marketing a project. And off the back of that, they've seen a material uplift in the value of the project and the property that they own. That particular group, for instance, might not make much more money through the construction phase of that development. So they might want to look to get an equity return, reinvest that capital into another project that's going to generate them returns. But for them, all they're going to look at is what's the cost of the debt versus where I might be able to redeploy that capital and can I generate a higher return. And so from their perspective, if it's a locked-in profit that they've been able to achieve, then for them it's simply what is the most appropriate capital structure and have they got alternative or better uses for the capital that can drive a higher return than the cost of the debt that we might charge. But equally, a lot of it comes down to our ability to negotiate. So for instance, there are situations where we look at companies that we lend to, and the returns that are able to be achieved for shareholders or equity are really driven off the provision of the debt financing that our investors are providing. And so our view is that our investors should be rewarded for that capital. And if we can negotiate a situation where we might be able to give our investors an acceptable debt return, but also give them the ability to participate in upside gains through equity or options or warrants that we might have negotiated gives our investors not only a debt coupon, but potential capital gains through other instruments that we've been able to negotiate directly with the company. But it's fair to say that not all of our funds are structured to deliver in excess of 7%. So, for instance, we span the entire risk spectrum from very high investment grade to sub-investment grade borrowers, but we also participate from senior unsecured debt all the way through to equity in the capital structure. And so what that gives us is the ability to be relevant to a lot of companies and management teams and project proponents looking for funding that are in private markets where we've got an ability to provide flexible alternative sources of funding to really assist those companies to deliver on what they're trying to do. But for us, it's about understanding what is the risk associated with that company. So for instance, if it was a government PPP, public-private partnership, and it was an investment grade facility, the returns that we'd be generating on that will be much lower, but they would reflect the investment grade nature of the asset that we hold. Equally, if we were lending to say it was a property development transaction and we're providing some mezzanine finance and say the loan to valuation ratio was in excess of say 65% or 70%, then that borrower will pay a much higher price for the debt because of the higher level of risk that you're taking. So really it's a continuum from low risk to high risk. Our proposition to our investors is we're skilled, we're experienced, we know how to originate, negotiate, structure, and manage the risks associated with lending to companies. Have we then delivered our investors a range of choices? So we look to provide our investors with different funds and different vehicles where they can understand what is the return objective of the fund, how much risk am I taking to achieve that return, and then what are the liquidity options that are available to me through the vehicle that I'm investing in. So a great way for investors to participate in our market has been through the ASX listed funds where they've been able to obtain liquidity through trading those units on the stock exchange, which is really unusual because most of the assets that we hold are not traded. They're loans that are held to maturity. You know, you lend a company money for 3 years, you're not looking to trade it, you're not a seller or an active buyer or a seller. We're looking to manage the risk associated with lending that company over, say, a three-year period. But the way in which an investor can be able to buy and sell and gain access to that exposure without having to hold the asset for, say, 3 years is to be able to buy and sell those units on the stock exchange.
Given that most credit investments are generally tied to either the RBA cash rate or some kind of similar overnight rate, something along those lines, how would you expect the asset class as a whole to perform in an environment of rising interest rates? And do you guys employ any strategies to try and protect your investors against the possibility of higher rates?
Higher rates actually flow through in terms of an increase to the total return. So it's very different to investing in, a bond fund. So bond funds, obviously the capital value of a bond goes higher as interest rates reduce. If interest rates start to increase, then the capital value or the risk of an investor's investment in a fixed rate bond fund becomes higher and they lose capital value. For us, if interest rates decline, the total cash coupon or the cash return that investor receives goes lower. But equally, if interest rates rise, you find that the total return to the investor is increasing. So the return that we're able to deliver for our investors is partly through fee income. So upfront fees or establishment fees charged to the companies we lend to. And they might range from, you know, a very small amount to a higher fee, depending on the term and the complexity of the transaction. We also generate a base fee, which is based off that floating rate, often pretty well correlated to the RBA cash rate and the bank's own cost of funding. And then also then there's a credit margin that attaches based on the risk and the term of the facility and the kind of borrower that you're lending to. So the returns that we're able to generate might be anywhere from, you know, 100 basis points over the RBA cash rate or the bank bill rate for a solid investment grade corporate borrower through to, you know, 10, 15, 20%, depending on the risk profile of the company you lend to. So from our perspective, The thing we're trying to do for investors is not protect them necessarily from movements in interest rates, because we're concerned if interest rates go lower, because we're trying to ensure that our investors are getting a consistent return, and maybe we switch our return profile to fee income rather than, you know, just simply accepting the coupon or the interest rate that's being generated. We might rather generate fee income for our investors to smooth and provide a better return. But equally, if interest rates were to rise, we want to give our investors the opportunity to participate in that rising rate environment. Obviously, people worry about how does it flow through to borrowers and their capacity to service and repay the debt if interest rates rise. But, you know, the way in which we assess the risk is, you know, there's always a material buffer for the financial performance of companies. It's not like we're an equity investor. So from our perspective, equity is the asset class that should be the most volatile and highest risk asset class, because you're investing in equity to gain capital growth and capital gains, whereas you're investing in the debt of the company for lower risk but more consistent, reliable income and capital stability. You're not going to get the, the significant capital gains investing in MXT, for instance. It's a relatively capital stable. You know, you think about it, you lend a company a dollar, you know, at the end of it for 3 years, you'll get the interest and fee income on that money that you've lent. At the end of the 3 years, you'll be looking to be repaid your dollar. It's not like you're going to get $1.50 or $2 at maturity. So the ability to generate capital gains is not there. So from our perspective, what we're looking to do is protect our investors from the risk of credit loss by having a well-diversified spread of exposures where you reduce the single exposure that you have to any one individual borrower.
I wonder if you could explain, we've spoken a couple of times about capital structure, referred to senior debt. I don't think we have referred to subordinated debt, but I was wondering if you could explain what do you actually mean when you're talking about capital structure? And I know there's going to be a range, but maybe you could give us a bit of an idea of typically where a lot of your investments fall on that capital structure, and just what's the significance of that?
Capital structure just really refers to the way in which a company or a project is funded. So for instance, you'll be looking for, if you're buying an asset, you might have a certain amount as your own cash equity, and then you'll have a component that you might want to borrow. And that represents the debt part of the capital structure. But the total of it, the mix of debt and equity, represents the structure of the company or the capital structure associated with the company you lend to. So for instance, say if a group is buying a company, they might sort of say, I'm buying this business on a enterprise value where the earnings are a particular multiple. You know, so the total enterprise value might be a earnings multiple of, 10 times. So if the business is worth $100 million, there might be a mix of debt and equity in the capital structure. It might be that $50 million of the 100 is equity. So somebody's come up with $50 million of cash equity. And then you look to lenders to provide an additional $50 million of debt. So the debt can then be structured to reflect the risk that a lender might take. So in that case, the highest risk in the capital structure will be the equity. Then the next layer of the capital structure might be some subordinated debt. So the subordinated debt might be, $10 or $10 million. So the equity is 50. The subordinated debt might be 10, taking it to then 40 million as the remaining capital being the senior debt. So the way to think about it is people are investing in equity because they think that, the 50 million might end up being worth $100 million. If the company's earnings grow and the multiple expands, and so the value of the company might go up, that increase in value accrues to the equity holder, doesn't accrue to the debt holders. The subordinated debt and the senior debt would be lower risk if the company's earnings grow and the value of the company becomes larger and there hasn't been any increase in the debt component of the capital structure. But the value that's been gained is going and flowing through to equity, but lowering the risk associated with a lender or the debt providers in the capital structure. So if I think about a property transaction, for instance, we often talk loan to valuation ratio. And so you might have a situation where the senior debt might represent, say, a loan to valuation ratio of 50%. Again, the property is worth $100 million, the senior debt component, loan to valuation ratio at 50%, $50 million. There might be some mezzanine or subordinated debt that might be prepared to take the total debt in the capital structure to say 70%. So a further $20 million of debt would be subordinated or mezzanine. So it ranks in priority lower than the rights that accrue to the senior lender. So it's all about who determines the risk, who gets money first, what are the obligations of the borrower to the respective holders of debt, subordinated debt or mezzanine debt and senior debt. But in all cases, what a lender is looking to do is to ensure that the interests of equity are aligned, that the management and the performance of the company or the project or the borrower are aligned with the interests of debt holders, so that they wear the risk of loss, because you're investing in equity to get the upsized capital gains. Therefore, you should be willing to accept a greater share of the risk to the downside. So in certain circumstances, if you think about that property example, for instance, that I gave, senior debt geared at 50% loan to valuation ratio, subordinated or mezzanine debt taking the total loan to valuation ratio up to say 70%, there's still 30% of the capital structure that is at risk to equity. So you could effectively see a decline in the value of that property or that project by 30% before lenders were at risk of losing $1.
Well, it sounds like you're pretty well prepared either way they go from here, but I'd still be really interested to hear your take on interest rates. It's, you know, there's an old saying, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. But there's often something to be learned in going through that process and thinking about possibilities and where things could go. So looking at kind of a base case scenario, what are your expectations for where rates go from here?
Look, again, I guess from our perspective, what we're looking at is what are the sources of income that are available to our investors? And that source of income might be fee income. It might be a base interest rate and a margin. So from our perspective, what we're looking to do is to structure our portfolios to ensure that we've got different sources of income from a well-diversified portfolio of investors or borrowers to mitigate sort of any macro or real impact is associated with sort of material movements in interest rates. So for instance, if interest rates were to decline, then hopefully we've generated revenue for our investors through fee income that's charged to borrowers. Interest rates go up, the fee income might decline, but the total return the investor might go up because you're charging more on the interest rate. I guess, where do I think rates are and where do they go? Again, it comes back to our philosophy. You know, you want to lend for shorter periods of time to reduce that kind of market risk in terms of the portfolio and the assets you hold. But I think there are a range of things that are on the macro environment that will flow through in the Australian economy that may have an impact in terms of where rates go. And I think right at the moment, we've got outbreaks of illness and disease. The flow-on effects associated with the coronavirus, for instance, might be material, and that may impact economic growth and activity. We've just come through a situation with the material impact of the bushfires. Again, the likely flow-on effect to the macro economy from those sorts of things will be uncertain and could be quite material in terms of how it impacts on economic growth. So I guess our view would be rates are not likely to be rising in the immediate term as a result of some of these impacts. But, you know, the flip side to that is, you know, where's the consumer? What's employment markets look like? Is there growth in demand? Is there growth in activity that's driving these things? And I think there's been a lot of nervousness over the last period of time where, you know, consumers and businesses haven't been investing. And if I look at a lot of the companies that we lend to, for instance, I look at their 2018 numbers and I look at 2019 and where they're projected their performance to be in 2020. You're not seeing material uptick in earnings and growth. You know, it's generally a flat lining. Companies are not necessarily achieving the forward budget numbers that they expected to achieve. So that suggests to me that their performance is fine, but they're not growing as strongly as they would like. And when those sorts of things go through the economy, then that's sort of a reason why there's less demand for rising interest rates than we would otherwise expect.
Well, we're running out of time, so I'm going to jump into my favourite questions that I ask all of my guests. So we might have to rush these a little bit. We'll see how we go. First of all, could you share with us something you've read recently? It could be a book, an article, a piece of research, or anything that really blew you away.
That's a really tough question. I guess for me, I spend an awful lot of time and work reading, you know, research papers and material associated with our activities from a business. So even over the sort of Christmas New Year period, I think I was nose in a PDS document that was being prepared to be issued to the market that we've just recently launched. So the idea of having a nice summer holiday lying on the beach and reading a book just doesn't exist for me, unfortunately, at this point in time. But I enjoy what we do. I think what we've delivered in terms of the funds and the investment products and providing an alternative source of capital has been important for our market. And so from that perspective, I'm always happy to do what I do anyway.
So we'll go with the metrics capital raising documents then?
Yeah, that's right. The MXT PDS. Yeah, all 150 odd pages of it.
Well, look, if you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give your younger self just one single piece of investing advice, what would it be?
Start early, diversify your portfolios, never think you're better than the market, do the research and really delve into, you know, what is it that's really driving the cash flows associated with the companies you've lent to. I think also, the idea of, looking for sort of non-public market opportunities to invest, investing in your business, investing in private market assets are all things that have been good for me. Hopefully that's some help.
Now, before I jump into this last question, I know you're not an equity investor. But that being said, you probably got a better understanding of the businesses and the finances and the balance sheet of Australian companies than most would in various places in the market. So I'd really love to get your unique perspective on this question, even if I know I will be putting you a little bit outside of your usual area of expertise. Before I ask the question, though, I always like to insert a little bit of a disclaimer. Don't try this at home. I'm not actually suggesting to anybody that they should go out there and put all their money in a single stock and forget about it for 5 years. This is supposed to be a bit of an exercise in long-term thinking and hopefully a little bit of fun. So with that being said, if you knew that the markets were going to close for 5 years starting from tomorrow, given your knowledge and understanding of business in Australia, what company would you be most comfortable investing in?
If I was a true credit person, I'll have to answer it in the reverse. Where would I avoid? So I think from our perspective, there's an awful lot of structural change in certain industries. And, I think from our perspective, one thing that we do worry about is the rate of structural change in certain industries and the way that might impact you as a lender. You know, obviously as a lender, you're not looking to participate in the growth and the upside, but you do worry about the downside risks that might impact your investments. And so we're looking for companies that have good long-term sustainable market positions, well-diversified business models, quality management, and a good strategic direction and agenda that can deliver future growth as a means of mitigating our risk. So, look, we've been quite vocal over the last number of years about certain industries that we have thought have gone through and continue to face into difficult structural conditions. And I think they are quite clearly the media sector, quite clearly the retail sector. And I think also, people might not want to accept this because, a lot of the Australian market is focused in on owning the banks because of the attractive dividends that have been historically distributed. But, certainly the banking industry is undergoing considerable upheaval and threat. And as a result of that, I don't think it would be an area where I'd be comfortable as a hold, you know, hold and forget type investor investing in companies in either of, or any of those three sectors. I think most of the time, though, for us as a lender, you genuinely think that most companies should have some form of sustainable capital structure that would support some element or level of debt. You know, there are industries that are more challenging as a lender. So, for instance, you know, commodity exposed, resource exposed industries where you get much more material movements in market pricing, they are challenging sectors to lend to. So, again, you know, these are the companies for us. You know, I'd hate the concept or hate the thought of closing up and not looking at our portfolio over a 5-year period. You know, we manage the risk on a day-to-day basis. We're across the detail, and the idea that, you know, you have to be knowledgeable about the companies, their performance, and track the progress of management and the financial aspects of the business to ensure that your risk is well protected. That's kind of how we would look at it, rather than closing up and just hoping for the best over the next 5-year period, that management and industries will just truck along nicely and deliver great outcomes for investors. I don't think that's the way we think.
Well, thankfully for all of us, it's not going to happen. I don't think the ASX is planning to shut up anytime soon. But look, Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been really great to get your insights into this, you know, lesser known and really unique and fascinating asset class.
Thanks, Patrick. Really appreciate the opportunity to participate. Thank you again.